WNYC in New York. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, a staggering spy story. Robert Philip Hansen was apparently caught passing secret documents to the Russians. The arrest of Hansen appears to have ended a 15-year career in espionage that may have resulted in the deaths of two Russian double agents. It was thoroughly covered by everyone, including the New York Times.
This put us in the mind of the last time that Times gave star treatment to an alleged spy. It was March of 1999, and the accused was a scientist named Wen-Ho Lee. Lee was suspected of passing American nuclear secrets to China, and a series of articles citing unnamed officials condemned Lee. The man was fired and jailed, but the charges never stuck. The newspaper eventually offered a qualified apology. We thought it might be interesting to compare how the Times handled both cases using a few key criteria.
Like reference to place of birth. In its first story naming Lee, the Times used the phrase Taiwan-born in the first sentence and repeatedly in the stories that followed.
In Hansen's case, the 18th paragraph in a sidebar story mentions he was born in Chicago.
As historical precedents, in Lee's case, the Times cited two other Taiwan-born scientists who were also suspected of spying, and another scientist named Lee, no relation, who was convicted. Also the Rosenbergs.
For Hansen, they cited Aldrich Ames.
For hard evidence on Lee, the Times mentioned two lie detector tests. The second suggested he was being deceptive.
The hard evidence on Hansen included incriminating letters, fingerprints on a garbage bag that contained bribe money, and the fact that he was arrested minutes after he had dropped off a bag of classified documents.
The circumstantial evidence on Lee included his refusal to cooperate with investigators, his wife's tendency to invite herself to gatherings at the lab with Chinese delegations, official trips to China, and a reference to an unnamed scientist who used to take pencils home to his kids.
No circumstantial evidence cited for Hansen, but did I mention the incriminating letters, the fingerprints on the bag of money, and the stolen documents? It's amazing how different two spy stories can look when one of them is reported completely on the record.
This week, another newspaper printed an apology, the Boston Globe. The paper was retracting an earlier report that police were investigating the murders of married Dartmouth College professors Half and Susan Zantop as a crime of passion, most likely resulting from an adulterous love affair. Soon after, two teenage boys were arrested, and the adultery angle was apparently dropped. Globe editor Matt Storin wrote, "It was certainly never our intent to increase the suffering of the Zantop family, their friends, or the Dartmouth College community, and we express regret for the pain our story undoubtedly caused them." The Globe's mistake, though much more quickly remedied, was not unlike one made by the Times in the Wen-Ho Lee case, relying on sources who proved unworthy of that trust. Boston Globe editor Matt Storin joins us now. Welcome to On the Media.
You're welcome, Brooke.
Certainly you can be sorry about causing pain, but did you do anything wrong journalistically by reporting a story in progress?
Well, I don't think that the reporter certainly did anything wrong, but I can see now that the sources that we were talking to, although they were telling us what they knew and or felt they knew, were running a little bit behind the events. Maybe that was just bad luck, but at just about the time we were completing our reporting on this story, they were beginning to shift their attention to the two young men who were ultimately arrested. I mean, one problem, unfortunately, was that some of the investigators were really not dealing with the press at all, and they really weren't taking questions, so that you could get steered in a different direction, perhaps, if different investigators felt differently than our sources did. Now, we did have our best people on this, and I'm really not criticizing them, but if were we doing this week, I suspect there would be other questions we would ask.
Is this the traditional tension between getting it first and getting it right?
That is certainly a factor, and it always has been in a competitive situation, and we're in a two-newspaper town, and I suspect it always will be.
I'd like to ask you in general about off-the-record sources in law enforcement. When the Times was reporting on Wen-Ho Lee and got ahead of itself and had to apologize, and then much earlier, the notorious Richard Jewell case, the so-called Atlanta bomber who turned out not to be, all the reporters in those cases were working off of sources inside law enforcement. How much credence can you give to what they tell you?
I think the most important factors are, A, that you have experienced reporters who know how to evaluate not only the information they're getting, but know how to evaluate the sources themselves. B, you have to think about what the fluidity of the investigation may be. How much of a breakthrough have you arrived at where it is safe to go public? And C, I would say you have to be aware, and I'm not saying this happened in our instance, of investigators using the press for their own purposes to try to smoke someone out by publication. You have to remember, with all due respect to law enforcement officials, that they are not journalists. Their missions are different.
And so the moral of the story is wait?
Just be careful and skeptical. But on the other hand, just because a mistake is made, you also should not be overly cowed about aggressive reporting.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Matthew Storin is the editor of the Boston Globe.
If you knew that 3 or 4 times a year an NBA player would die on the court, would you encourage your kid to be a basketball fan? Before you write that off as a preposterous question, consider that is precisely the situation with NASCAR. The death of popular racer Dale Earnhardt last week is being played out in televised memorials as a horrific event. But with Fox, NBC, and Turner Sports paying collectively $2.5 billion to televise NASCAR over the next 6 years, a human tragedy can become a marketing liability. On the Media's Mike Pesca reports.
On the bottom of the television screen, Michael Waltrip was crossing the finish line at the Daytona 500. On the audio track, Michael's brother Darrell was whooping it up in his role as Fox Sports racing analyst. At the top of the screen could be seen a plume of smoke, a crash on the third turn. At the moment of victory, barely commented upon. Since then, racing has discussed nothing else. What should have been a dream telecast for Fox Sports turned into the race that a record 32 million viewers would never forget. Many viewers were watching their first NASCAR event ever. It's conceivable that they could think of Dale Earnhardt's death as a freak accident. They might not have known the recent history of NASCAR racing.
Earnhardt is not just the biggest name to die. He is the fourth in 9 months.
Ed Hinton is the auto writer for the Chicago Tribune and many of the other papers in the Tribune chain.
For 20 years, I've been hearing him say this. It was meant to be. Well, 4 and 9 months of the same preventable injury, that's a lot of meant to be, guys. Their fatalism tells them that it's meant to be. My understanding of science tells me it doesn't have to be.
The science Hinton speaks of was documented in a series of articles he wrote for the Tribune papers. Among his findings, NASCAR, unlike all other forms of professional racing, doesn't fund its own medical team to travel from race to race. NASCAR doesn't mandate the use of the head and neck safety or hands device, which along with other procedures has eliminated fatalities from Formula One racing over the last 7 years. NASCAR would not contribute to a universal database on crash trauma and fatalities. NASCAR officials have been slow to establish so-called soft wall technology, which could lessen the impact of a crash. Even Dale Earnhardt, famously reluctant to embrace safety technology, told Hinton that he didn't buy NASCAR's arguments that soft walls would flake off and litter the track. Hinton recalls Earnhardt told him,
"I'd rather they spend 20 minutes cleaning up that mess than to clean me off the wall."
That quote ran exactly 1 week before Dale Earnhardt's death. In the week after, the television commentary was generally defensive in the face of overwhelming evidence.
In my opinion, NASCAR racing is the safest form of racing in all of sports.
Dr. Jerry Punch commenting on ESPN the night of Earnhardt's death. Punch's status as one of racing's highest profile commentators was established in part because he's a physician specializing in treating trauma. Despite the scientific evidence, and despite the deaths of driver after driver, many of whom Punch counted as his friends, he still equivocated when asked about the hands device.
It wouldn't have made a difference at Dale Earnhardt's injury. 170 or 160 mile an hour impact to Dale Earnhardt, going from that to zero in a millisecond, I don't think it would have made any difference.
To Ed Hinton, it was typical of the ill-informed post-crash commentary.
I haven't seen one person on television in the aftermath of Dale Earnhardt's death who I would consider an expert in the function of the Hans device. When they put Dr. John Melvin, who's the world's leading expert on what causes racing injury and who has done the latest cutting-edge research, they'll say, there is an independent expert.
John Melvin is former head of safety at General Motors and a specialist in the field of bioengineering.
It's such a special topic. Nobody is really very skilled in it other than those of us that work in it. And that includes doctors. They treat injury, but they really don't understand how they occur. Everybody that says that the car crashed into the wall at 180 miles an hour is wrong, basically. And it's that kind of misinformation that is out there that makes it sound a lot more difficult and almost hopeless problem than I think we feel in the crash injury area that it really is.
Hinton says too many NASCAR analysts are NASCAR apologists, but he also says that the NASCAR culture itself is often a barrier to addressing safety problems.
They have been made fun of as a podunk, redneck, blood sport for so long that they still have that us against the world mentality, and it hasn't quite dawned on them that all of North America is beginning to pay attention to them.
As much as it wants to hold on to its roots as a daring assortment of whiskey runners from the Carolinas, NASCAR has moved into the big time. Its drivers are all rich, it's the second most highly rated television sport behind football, it is the number one spectator sport in America. Given the price the networks are paying to televise NASCAR, they're forced to broaden the fan base to include new viewers. Still, $2.5 billion doesn't buy safety reform. Dan Bell, director of communication for Fox Sports, says that a network can publicize, televise, and market, but they can't force rule changes.
The safety issue, you know, it's a concern, but it basically is a NASCAR issue, and it's not for us to go to NASCAR and say, hey, you need to do this and you need to do that. No, absolutely not.
Fox is not only going to have to answer to the hardcore NASCAR TV audience and the new casual audience it's bringing in. I think they're going to have to answer to civilization now.
Ed Hinton says that the impetus for change might come from car sponsors. Advertisers don't want to be associated with death, nor do automobile companies who stress safety as their number one selling point. By positioning themselves as mainstream and family-friendly, NASCAR and the network set themselves up for more than a financial windfall. They set themselves up for scrutiny. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
Coming up, we track the history of black Americans on network TV, and a black Canadian explains why he hates BET.
Please write us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. Welcome back to On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When a Scottish court recently returned a guilty verdict against Libyan defendant Abdelbaset Aliyah Megrahi in the 13-year-old Lockerbie case, one less-than-casual observer was Paul Foote. Foote, a veteran British newspaper journalist, then writing for the alternative weekly Private Eye, had been reporting on the case for 12 years and had excoriated the prosecutors for what he describes as gaping holes in their case. The conviction may have brought relief to families of the airline bombing's 270 victims, But to Foote, who subscribes to the original prosecution theory that the bombing was the work of Palestinian terrorists working in concert with Syria and Iran, it was a miscarriage of justice. I asked him what it was like to see 12 years' worth of journalistic efforts come so dramatically to nothing.
I felt aggrieved in that I was sure an injustice had been committed, but that's not the first time that I've been involved in a case where I feel a terrible injustice has been committed. You know, that's my feeling. It isn't one of, oh, I've missed something myself. I mean, I don't feel that at all. I've got no more stake in it in that I'm a journalist, and it's not the same as, say, a relative of someone who's died. I'm not connected with it that way, except I've stated a point of view. I still held that point of view, and the judges took a different point of view, and I think they were wrong.
Now, you were suspicious of the official theories about this case from the very beginning, long before actually Libyan suspects were being discussed.
What really caused me to be suspicious was that the switch in the hunt. The original hunt was for a Palestinian terrorist gang, which had been known to blow up aircraft, and which indeed had been making bombs disguised in Toshiba cassette recorders, as indeed was the bomb that blew up the plane at Lockerbie. Now, all the initial suspicion was about that gang, and a lot of evidence was collected against that gang. Then suddenly, in end of 1990 and beginning of 1991, that hunt seems to come to a stop. And President Bush actually said, Syria have taken a bum rap on this. In other words, we've been wrong to go for Syria. We're going to go for someone else.
And this corresponded with President Bush's coalition building in the Gulf War, in which Syria was part of the allied
coalition. Well, that, I believe, provides a motive for the switch, because it was a crucial ally in the Gulf War.
You've been writing your stories on Lockerbie lately for The Private Eye, which is an alternative weekly newspaper.
If you're very flattering, you'd describe it like that, yes.
And I hesitate to call it marginal because it isn't marginal.
It is marginal in the sense that it has circulation of about 160,000.
Yes.
It's not like getting it in one of the tabloids or something, or even in, you know, the mainstream quality papers.
The mainstream publications?
Well,
you
can see a number of articles, not as many as I think you should see. For instance, the Guardian correspondent obviously isn't happy with the verdict.
So comes now the verdict, the conviction of one of the Libyan suspects, and with it, closure. Do you think there is really closure on this case? Will people put it to rest now, particularly among the victims' families?
Well, no, I absolutely understand people's desire for it to be closed, especially since I know some of these people quite closely now. But the answer that has been come out of the court is so utterly unsatisfactory. You know, I don't believe that man was guilty. And certainly I don't believe they proved he was guilty. I've been involved in my life in a large number of miscarriages of justice. In almost all of them, it took months, years in many cases, for the holes to appear in the prosecution case. In this case, the holes are so immediately clear. It's so absolutely obvious that the thing is inadequate. I mean, it's not just me. I think there are quite a few journalists who are absolutely staggered by the verdict.
I'll ask you to make a prediction. If it's true that the intelligence services and the governments of the United States and Great Britain don't wish for the truth to be told, that there is fabricated evidence and that the Lockerbie trial intentionally pointed the blame in the wrong direction, do you think journalists will ever be able to get to the bottom of it?
Well, I'm 63 years old. I'm getting on now. I'm inclined to be slightly pessimistic about these things, but I do think that there are lots of young journalists who have a story here of the most monumental proportions, which if they've got any guts and common sense, they could put together. And I very much hope that they do that, because in the end, when you're telling a lie and against the interests of so many people, there's a very good chance that you can be exposed.
Mr. Foote, thank you for joining us.
Okay, thanks.
Paul Foote, a columnist at the Daily Mirror for 14 years, is a freelance journalist living in London.
According to the Toronto Globe and Mail this week, Black Entertainment Television burst onto the arguably colorless Canadian TV screen with a rallying cry of "Buy Blacks and for Blacks." Trouble is, a vocal number of Canada's 600,000 blacks really can't stand BET. One of those critics is Clifton Joseph, a correspondent with the CBC's media watchdog program Undercurrents, and he joins us now. Mr. Joseph, welcome to On the Media.
Hey, how's it going in the great bad South?
Oh, not bad this week. What is your principal complaint about BET?
Well, I guess BET has failed the community in Toronto, in Canada, the black community, and it certainly has failed the black community in America, I think. When they came over here to get on air on the TV channels over here, they canvassed the black community. And, of course, it was, as they say, by blacks for blacks. We didn't realize it was just going to be black videos and some old black sitcoms. So while BET is making $250 million a year before they were bought out by Viacom, they certainly, I don't think, is a true expression of black culture, and that they actually fit into some of the worst stereotypes happening today.
Did BET promise something different when it lobbied the Canadian authorities for broadcast rights?
When you're lobbying people, you're not lobbying with as much specifics. Like, they didn't come and say, well, we need your support so that we can just play the same 40 hip-hop and R&B videos with, women shaking their booties and all that. It was a whole sense of, brothers and sisters have to stick together to get this channel on the ear, and somehow BET on the ear will have some kind of positive effect on black people in this country. I think it's probably been the opposite.
How so? What are the stereotypes that you refer to? What are the shows that you refer to that you think are having actually a negative effect up there?
Well, maybe I can contextualize the situation here in Toronto. We have the city population is nearly 4 million. Black people, mostly from the Caribbean, make up about 400,000 of that. The population of this city is 54% colored. It's the most diverse city of black people on the planet. So we are hoping that we would get more than the extremely narrow range of programming that BET offers. If you're not in that 18 to 24 black, if you're not a super duper into hip hop and mainstream R&B, there virtually is very little for you on BET except for the 1 hour from 11 to midnight with Tavis Smiley and my man Ed Gordon. And I don't think that that's the proper use of the airwaves for the situation that the black people find themselves in America, and certainly not here in Canada. We're supposed to be satisfied with BET just playing some jive-ass videos.
And you're looking for more public affairs content, and specifically Canadian public affairs content?
Well, I'd like to see more public affairs content, period. I mean, I'd like to know what's going on in black America more than just the videos. I mean, what is it? Upwards of 65% of the programming on that on BET is videos. And the other thing is, we hardly see any of our Canadian entertainers profiled. They actually treat us like the ugly stepbrothers. We were hoping for more black solidarity, tell you the truth. And it seems to me that it's pretty duplicitous for them to come to this country, Canada, canvass us for our assistance, and then after they get it, dash us away like we don't even matter.
Clifton Joseph, thank you very much.
Right on.
Clifton Joseph is a correspondent with the CBC's media watchdog program, Undercurrents. African-American actors have had a long, distinguished, but frequently frustrating run on network television. Ethel Waters was one of the first to transcend the narrow character she was handed, that of Beulah, the cheerful, self-sacrificing maid to a white family. The last half century has seen blacks on a fascinating journey from Beulah to the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and beyond, and it's all chronicled in a new book by Donald Bogle called Primetime Blues. Mr. Bogle, welcome to On the Media. Set the scene in the 1950s for the portrayals of blacks on television.
Images of African Americans in popular culture had started to change after the Second World War. We're seeing in America the rise of the civil rights movement, but television lags behind. the first series that really brings the black woman into American homes on the weekly primetime schedule was a series called Beulah, The Story of a Black Maid. You also had Amos and Andy during that period, and Eddie Rochester Anderson. He's on the TV show The Jack Benny Show.
You often point out that the actors transcended their material, certainly Ethel Waters as Beulah did that, and you suggest that Rochester was actually a departure from The Servant, not just because he was smarter, but because he didn't sacrifice himself.
And, you know, they really tailored the scenes for Rochester. It's funny when you see him get the better of Jack Benny.
I wonder what's wrong with him. He's kept himself locked in the den all day. The last time he brooded like this was when his girlfriend, Gladys Zabisco, broke their engagement. Then she sent back the ring and he was happy again.
Let's move now to the 60s. I Spy is our introduction to Bill Cosby, who becomes a fixture marking the passage of black images throughout the rest of the history of television.
Yes. It's interesting. Sheldon Leonard, who produced I Spy, he had seen Cosby on TV and decided he wanted to do this thing with a white character and a black character who become buddies. You know, for television at that time, this was certainly something new.
Also in the 60s, you had Diane Carroll starring as Julia, a nurse, a single parent, and she got criticized in the era for doing that role.
She ended up being criticized. I mean, on the one hand, it was a progressive image that we do have an educated African-American woman. Her husband killed in Vietnam. She's got a young son to raise. They go to Los Angeles. She lives in an integrated apartment building. Her son's best friend is a little white kid. But here it is, 1968. She's in Los Angeles. Her experience there doesn't seem at all to have been touched by Watts. But nonetheless, the criticism of Julia really indicates that the black audience starved for images. Sometimes we'll want one show to answer all its needs, and it can't do that.
Addressing some of the issues of black anger in the period was Link, one of the trio that formed the Mod Squad, as they said, the white, the black, and the blonde. And, of course, Link was the angry black man who seethed inwardly pretty much throughout the whole series, and yet they were still doing the cops' work.
Exactly. Link had experienced Watts, and Clarence Williams III was just a great presence. He had that big afro, and he had that sort of surly look. But basically, the Mod Squad are cops. You know, at a time when there were campus takeovers and disorders in the streets of America and urban areas, the Mod Squad, basically, they're not there to tear down the system. They are basically going to support it.
Let's leap ahead now to the 70s. Something very curious happened in the 70s. There were three black shows in the top 10. There was Sanford and Son, Jefferson's, and Good Times.
Yep. Audiences wanted black shows with more of an ethnic flavor, and black shows that somehow, even though these shows were sitcoms, were going to comment on racial issues in America.
Where you been so long?
Fighting crime in the streets, Mr. Sanford. We are going to get it to the point where people can walk anywhere in Los Angeles.
Yeah, but they'd still be running in Watts.
The difference between Sanford and Son is something like Amos and Andy. Amos and Andy... Sometimes white characters showed up, but never was the theme of race or racism going to be there. Never. And it was almost for the black characters in Amos and Andy as if race didn't exist. But it does exist in Sanford and Son, and that, you know, that was significant. You know, my real complaint, though, about that period, we have those three shows, you know, in the top of the ratings, but television still prefers to give us a black cast in a sitcom.
Now let's leap ahead to the 80s. Let us begin with the show that people never stop talking about, the blockbuster hit, Cosby.
The Cosby Show. You look at the basic situations on the Cosby Show. The family endures or experiences the same things that any other kind of family in America does. And that's what kept the mainstream audience watching. But at the same time, Cosby always had these cultural points of identification for his black viewers. He never lost his black following.
It's worth noting that this is a program where blacks were in charge of their material.
Exactly.
In the 80s, you also have dramas that feature black characters and not as goof-offs in Hill Street Blues and in Saint Elsewhere.
Yeah, you do. But the interesting thing is that these are still really not black dramas. These are workplace dramas, much like ER and The Practice are today. And we do have important black characters, and some issues are dealt within those shows. But you look at St. Elsewhere, you don't really see nearly enough of Denzel Washington.
With the 90s, you have the creation of new networks like Fox and the WB and UPN, and you have the rise of a whole host of new programs, some of which reach a mass audience, like The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and some of which don't.
It's interesting when we look at what happened to television, you know, as the 90s went along. I mean, the networks ultimately abandoned black programming, or the black series. And then these new networks, Fox, WB, UPN, they've really built their foundations on black programming. You got to a point by the late 90s where black America and white America were viewing different things. Black households, black viewers still want to see some kind of representation about them in their community. But you're only getting it still in these sitcoms. And the sitcoms are really more for younger viewers. If you're African American and you do want to see more serious representations, then you have to go to a show like ER, which is not a black show, but has a leading black character, or you go to The Practice.
If you can't find it on the networks, can you find it on cable?
Well, I think that, you know, it's interesting. HBO, you know, it's aware it's got a black constituency, and it tries to meet the needs of that. They've done things like A Lesson Before Dying with Don Cheadle and Cicely Tyson. Walter Mosley's Always Outnumbered. Now Showtime is doing Soul Food, a series. I mean, there have been some extraordinary talents. We have been able to get that from TV. We just want television to give us fewer distortions and more realistic depictions.
And you conclude in your book that it wouldn't just be better for blacks, it would be better for television.
It would be better for television, exactly.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, Brooke, thank you.
Donald Bogle is the author of Primetime Blues, African Americans on Network Television.
In 1996, only one show hit it big with both black and white viewers, ABC's Monday Night Football. Not so this past fall. Eight shows turned up in the top 20 for both groups, the two weekly editions of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, then Monday Night Football, ER, The Practice, Touched by an Angel, 60 Minutes, and Judging Amy. UPN's The Parkers, with a mostly black cast, ranked second among blacks, but 119th among whites. Similarly, the white blockbuster Friends ranked 65th among black viewers. We sent On the Media's Dave Sirchuk up to Harlem to see how far Friends had penetrated there. Frankly, it made us doubt the ratings data because it did pretty well.
How's it going? We're doing a piece on TV. Who's your favorite friend?
Mine's Joy.
I would say Rachel.
Ross' girlfriend, what's her name? Jennifer Aniston?
Vivi. Yeah.
Chandler.
Why is he your favorite?
Because could he be any funnier?
I'll tell you the truth, I haven't seen it. I'm a musician, I'm never home.
I don't watch the show, I don't like it. Everything is exhibiting sex, and I don't go for that.
I'm interviewing people about the show Friends. I wanted to find out who their favorite friend was.
Phoebe and Joey. Joey and Phoebe are the funniest people on Friends.
Rumors are they might get together this year, you know.
I think that would be good. They should get married and have some kids.
But the kids would ruin the show.
Nah. It wouldn't ruin the show. Then if all of them can have kids, and then their kids can be friends and grow up, and we'll have another cereal.
Coming up, we'll continue watching TV. We'll look at the proliferation of gay characters, both in programs and commercials. Plus, why Thursday night is so important to the networks and to advertisers.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. February is Sweeps Month, crucial for television networks and stations when advertisers study the ratings to determine how much they're willing to pay for commercial time. So programmers desperately seeking viewers lard the schedule with specials, pitting the high class against the low brow. Or, as in this month, Anna Karenina versus The Osmonds. But the best entertainment by far this month has been the bare-knuckled battle for domination of Thursday night, as On the Media's Tony Macillas reports.
28 days, two television networks, one fickle audience. The prize for the winner of Sweeps Month? Control of the largest cash machine TV offers, Thursday night. From his cubicle at the New York Post, TV reporter Don Kaplan serves as tribal counsel on Thursday's battle.
NBC has dominated that night in terms of ratings for almost the last 20 years, and they make a lot of money. So it's quite a coup for CBS to be trying to make some sort of an inroad and steal their viewers.
Cosby and Cheers in the 1980s, Seinfeld and now Friends. NBC has been unchallenged on Thursday since the dawn of must-see TV. But this February, Friends confronted a powerful enemy in Survivor. The hit reality show attracted nearly 30 million viewers in its first season, enough to potentially knock NBC from its primetime pedestal. The stakes are high. Steve Grubbs is the CEO of OMD, a group that buys advertising time slots for clients like PepsiCo, Apple, and Universal Studios. He explains the importance of primetime Thursday from an advertiser's perspective.
You get a broad reach, difficult to reach younger, upscale demographics available there. If you're launching a new product, if you're launching a new creative execution, if you're trying to develop the big bang impact with advertisers, then Thursday night is the best vehicle around right now outside of a handful of major network specials.
Must See TV created a virtual monopoly on ad dollars. 30 seconds on a new episode of Friends can cost as much as $700,000, and sponsors pay gladly for the chance to catch young consumers before they make their weekend plans or spend their paychecks. NBC relies on Thursday night for most of its annual revenues, so the challenge from CBS was taken seriously. The network fired its entertainment president, Boy Wonder Garth Ancier, and replaced him with another Boy Wonder, the Today Show's Jeff Zucker. Zucker threw a curveball with a supersized Friends and a mini weeknight version of Saturday Night Live. Don Kaplan of the New York Post gives the verdict.
I think a lot of people are busting out their VCRs and taping both. I think you've got an incredible amount of crossover.
In the end, the ratings stayed the same. NBC didn't lose any viewers, and Survivor had the same audience it did last season. Jeff Zucker says this is a win for both networks.
We emerged from Thursday night in a terrific position, and CBS turned on the lights on Thursday night, and that's a great story for them. So I wouldn't begrudge anybody else their success, especially if it doesn't come at our expense.
Because CBS and NBC are pitting blockbuster against blockbuster, the same sponsors are sinking money into both, essentially competing with themselves. Why not deliver a must-see Wednesday instead? Media buyer Steve Grubbs.
I don't think CBS is necessarily maximizing the audience potential of Survivor. If they had put it on Wednesday night at 9 or Wednesday night at 10, I think you'd probably see a stronger rating performance there.
But CBS has no plans to move Survivor to another night. The show will remain on Thursdays until April, and the network also plans to challenge NBC's other darling, ER. A new Thursday night drama hits the 10 o'clock hour on CBS in March. Jeff Zucker says he'll fight by developing reality shows for NBC, the only network slow to join the fad. And he will also try to create more smash hits like Will and Grace, Cheers, and Friends.
I just don't make them like that anymore. No, they do, but you just have to wait.
The networks and their sponsors hope the wait won't be too long. In New York, I'm Tony Macillas for On the Media.
Will and Grace and If These Walls Could Talk Too both won Emmys. CBS has two gay-themed shows in the pipeline, and so many sitcoms have gay characters it's no longer newsworthy. Gay TV is staking its claim, declared Entertainment Weekly. On the other hand, the viewing public didn't buy John Goodman as a gay middle American in Normal, Ohio, and Ellen DeGeneres' career hasn't exactly rebounded since her sitcom died. Now comes Showtime's Queer as Folk. It's not a comedy or even a dramedy. What it is frankly, seriously sexual. So much so that one critic said it reminded him of nothing so much as a National Geographic special or one of those Mutual of Omaha shows. On the media's Rex Stone reports.
30 years ago, David Frost called television a medium in which viewers could be entertained in their living room by people they wouldn't have in their home. But even a visionary like Frost could not have anticipated a program like Queer as Folk.
Are you a top or a bottom?
Boundary pushing, provocative, bold. Those weren't the words of Queer as Folk's critics. They were taken from Showtime's own promotional campaign.
The series Queer as Folk. The question, is America ready?
I don't know if America's ever ready for anything. Until somebody does it.
Creating programming with controversial subject matter. And Showtime has been committed to pushing the boundaries with gay-oriented programs since the 80s, with the show Brothers to Armistead...
Showtime wanted Queer as Folk to be its Sopranos. The reality is far from that. But it is Showtime's highest-rated original program ever, and it has been picked up for a second season. What it hasn't achieved is a universal critical praise of the British miniseries that it was based on. It has also lost some of its depth and complexity. What's been left from the transatlantic transfer is the supercharged homoeroticism that is the primary and most distinguishing aspect of the show.
I think what's most important about a show like Queer as Folk is that here we're not looking for the queer who came to dinner, because that's already sort of an acceptable part of liberal society.
Richard Goldstein is an executive editor of the Village Voice and has written about gays in the media for the past 20 years.
We're looking at that element of gay life that is outside the liberal pale, that is still exists in a rich and unspoken form in the gay world. And it's the integration of that material into ordinary discourse that probably represents the truest measure of liberation.
The element of gay life that Goldstein speaks of is sex, and there's plenty of it in Queer as Folk. So much so that some in the gay community are concerned. Stephen Capsudo is the author of Alternate Channels, a history of gay images in television and radio.
Whether a show like Queer as Folk is good news for the gay community is something that can be debated. Certainly, on the one hand, it reinforces every negative stereotype. You have these characters who are club queens who are extremely promiscuous and use drugs. And in the first episode, you have a 29-year-old character bedding a high school student. So on a certain level, I think it's potentially dangerous.
That slice of unapologetic reality from the gay subculture's outer regions is exactly what appealed to Peter Page, who plays the ever-so-out Emmett on Queer as Folk.
The truth is, I don't care what straight people think about me. I'm interested in seeing a show that reflects some resemblance to my own life. And I see that in Queer as Folk. I know those guys. Those guys exist. There are plenty of effeminate gay men out there. It's just true. And whether or not you're proud of that or attracted to that or drawn to that or that's what you want to see out in the world, they exist. And to pretend they don't because there have been negative portrayals of them in the past, Emmett's a kick-ass guy.
In a scene from the second episode, Emmett supports that claim. It is a signature moment for Paige's character and for the series itself.
Well, I could be a real man if I wanted to. You know, just lower my voice, stop gesturing with my hands, make sure my face is expressionless. Never, never use words like fabulous or divine. Talk about, I don't know, nailing bitches and RBIs. But I'd rather my flame burn bright than be some puny little pilot light.
That proclamation alone represents a significant advance in the way in which homosexuality is portrayed on television. Advance is not necessarily reflected in real life, says the Village Voice's Richard Goldstein, though some people may confuse the two.
Because people easily confuse the images in entertainment with the nature of life, and people think that if something appears on television, it's going to be on their doorstep the very next day.
Which wouldn't be very boundary-pushing at all if the gays at America's doorstep were all like the wacky and wisecracking Will from Will and Grace.
And three, we don't talk about things that we don't want to know about.
So you admit there's a problem?
No, I don't. See how that works?
The overwhelming popularity of Will and Grace is just part of what seems like a nationwide embrace of openly gay characters on such network shows as Friends, Dawson's Creek, ER, and Spin City. But the acceptance of these primetime-friendly faces amounts to little more than what Richard Goldstein asserts is fantasy tolerance.
I think when people look at these shows and they see these characters, they might have the idea that that really is how gay people live, that they are completely integrated, and that there really is no difference except for a certain inflection, a certain sort of humor, and a certain capacity for double entendre.
By signaling that gay characters can do more than deliver punchlines and that homosexuality does in fact include sexuality, Queer as Folk has broken new ground in that grand social testing zone known as American television. It's tempting to read into the hits and flops that the success of Will and Grace means that gays have arrived, or that the failure of Normal Ohio means that America is just not ready. But the modest success of a show like Queer as Folk suggests a different possibility. It's that on American TV today, a homosexual theme is neither clever strategy or guaranteed obstacle. It's just another premise, the success or failure of which will depend on acting, writing, and time slot, just like everything else. For On the Media in New York, I'm Rex Doan.
The presence of gay characters on television is not limited to the programming. Increasingly, in depictions both positive and otherwise, homosexual characters and issues are finding their way into advertising as well. Journalist Michael Wilkie has cataloged these efforts on a website called commercialcloset.com.
Mom, Dad, if you're watching, I want you to know I finally found the person I want to spend the rest of my life with. Mom and Dad, this is Jen.
Hi.
Show your colors, Mystic.
Mike Wilkie, that is a pretty extraordinary thing to see on your television, even in, well, in this case, the year 2000, is it not?
Well, that's actually an older commercial from, you know, several years ago. You know, it ran on MTV, and its audience is a more progressive, younger audience who, you know, really isn't all that concerned with the idea of gay or lesbian people as being an issue. It's sort of a non-issue for that age group.
Isn't it also true that while there's quite a number of depictions of gay characters, even gay lead characters in television, primetime television programs, for example, that advertising has kind of lagged in that respect?
It really has. And what's true about my entire archive, really, and even though most of it has happened, let's say, in the last 6 or 7 years, most of it has only shown in pretty limited arenas. It will have been on MTV only, or it may just be in a couple of cities like New York, San Francisco, and LA or something, and they run briefly and then they're gone. And so a lot of people really never see them or even knew that they happened.
Historically, how was homosexuality, or at least the suggestion of homosexuality, depicted in television commercials?
Well, it was more often just a reference. It wasn't actually depicted directly. For example, a 1989 commercial from Kellogg's for its Nut and Honey cereal has this question, you know, asked of various people, and you know, it's supposed to be a joke response.
What'll it be?
Nut and Honey.
Ooh, just stop by to see me, huh, sugar?
So it has these various vignettes, and in the last one, it's always the last one that this happens in, there's a chuck wagon scene with a bunch of cowboys around a campfire or whatever, and there's a male cook there. And so they come up and ask him that question.
Hey, Cookie, what's for breakfast?
Nothing, honey.
And then they all pull their guns out on him, you know, threatening to shoot him for presumably calling them honey.
They felt their masculinity threatened by being called honey.
Exactly.
When did the commercial closet first open? Was there a moment of creation?
Really, I'd say 1994 with IKEA was a critical turning point in terms of awareness and then interest level in inclusion of lesbian or gay people in commercials.
Let's listen to a little bit of that commercial.
Well, you know, we went to IKEA because we thought it was time for a serious dining room table.
We have slightly different tastes. I mean, Steve's more into country. It frightens me, but at the same time, I have compassion.
We've been together about 3 years.
I met Steve at my sister's wedding.
IKEA was really a groundbreaking advertisement. It was the first time that anyone had included a gay couple in a non, humorous way. They were meant to sort of depict reality, and it showed two men shopping together, and frankly, it was such an unusual idea at the time that it made news around the world.
All right, now tell me about gay vague advertising. You identify on your website and have in your writing talked about ads that to one audience may seem perfectly innocuous, yet to a gay audience have some sort of hidden message.
Well, there are different motivations that can happen in the gay vague category. Sometimes it's actually an effort on the part of the advertiser, I believe, and other times I think it's more accidental. Now, a perfect example of perhaps an accidental one is Volkswagen's Da 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 commercial. Has two guys driving around aimlessly in a car on a Sunday afternoon. That commercial debuted on the coming out episode of the Ellen program, where she told everyone she was lesbian. And so it had a very big gay and gay-friendly audience watching at the time. When it came on, everyone sort of looked at each other and thought, are these two guys supposed to be boyfriends? And even though there were no lines in the commercial, there seemed to be a little je ne sais quoi about it that seemed to imply that. Now, Volkswagen said, we didn't intend for them to come off as gay, but it's okay if you want to think so.
There's this old joke about the guy in the psychiatrist's office, and the psychiatrist is showing him Rorschach ink blots. And the guy describes, as he looks at these blocks, one in a long, you know, in a succession of, you know, erotic images. And finally, the psychiatrist says to him, well, you know, Mr. Jones, it looks to me like you have some sort of obsession with sex. And the patient replies, well, you're the one with all the dirty pictures. Michael, are there really gay vague ads, or are you just seeing dirty pictures and ink blots?
No, because there are some also that are more intentional, in my opinion. In fact, when I was at Ad Age, I wrote about Parliament cigarettes ads. They have this campaign that's, of course, a long-running campaign in the mainstream media, which has a man and a woman in an exotic sort of seaside locale. And in gay magazines, what they've done is they've added another man into the picture. And one time, they actually took that extra step and made it just two men and their dog. After I wrote about it, though, they ended up pulling back. Someone later came up to me who had worked with Parliament, basically said to me that the company was upset after I wrote about it, that I had revealed what they were doing to the mainstream audience out there.
You outed them.
I outed them.
Michael Wilkie, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Michael Wilkie is the creator of The Commercial Closet. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Katya Rogers, Janine Price, and Alicia Zuckerman, engineered by George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from the Keefe brothers, Dylan and John, Kira Deppenbrock, and David Serchuk.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Shut up, dummy!
Funding for On the Media is made possible by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bydale Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.